Welcome back to Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falcoff with my guest today, Charles Osman. Gosh, where do we fine-tune this exciting information? Boy, you know, with what we were discussing, Charles, I think about my own ignorance and how I evolved over the years, the more I learned about the body and its structures, and you just look at how we work. We're extremely well-designed machines. There's no other way to look at it for me.
Well, let me throw a couple of thoughts in, which might be interesting for your audience. When I say we were made in the image of God, I meant that, but the question comes up, define God. And that's not to say I don't believe in a supreme entity or a collection of supreme entities or some kind of cosmological scale intelligence that we're sort of a piece of. I'm completely okay with that. But when somebody walks up to me waving a Bible with the New Testament version, something or another, and then shouts at me at the top of the lungs and shows me a picture of a guy with a beard, I'm not going to go there. But I'm very willing to accept the idea that something is larger than us and we're part of it. And I absolutely can go along with some kind of intelligent design-like strategy. Maybe I'm just kind of voicing a thought. But let me back up a square or two. If we were made in the, quote-unquote, image of God, then the first thing I think of is bioengineering. It sounds like cloning to me. In other words, okay, you find an organism that's kind of roughly within range of a proto-hominid, and I think, here's a couple quick thoughts. I think life is as common as beach sand. Now, there's been a lot of controversy about Mars. I didn't mean to change topics exactly, but it's something, of course, Richard C. Hogan's been involved with for a long time. But even without his work, to take a more sort of mundane view, if I can put it that way, a lot of folks are very, very solid in the idea that there is life on Mars. We've seen it. We know it's there. There are small sea creature type fossils. I've seen them myself personally. I know this stuff quite well. I've actually been to JPL a number of times for reasons I won't go into. But let's just say that a lot of folks behind the scenes, they know what's going on. It's very obvious. So there's going to come a certain point in the not too distant future, hopefully within Obama's reign, that some kind of a political out will be made, and these guys can come forward and begin to explain what they've really been looking at. And so, to go beyond Mars, to go outside our solar system, if you take a spectrographical analysis of the dust, of the other sort of cosmic materials, guess what? You find proteins out there. You find all kinds of biological molecular components. You see the absorption spectra of those biological materials. It's everywhere. Life is not rare at all. And I think where we really went way, way wrong with some of the big religions here on this planet was this crazy idea that we're the center of the universe and we're the only ones and life can only begin and here. You know, that's where it went unbelievably wrong because it really created a lot of terrible problems that we're trying to unravel now. But if we're willing to step outside that box just for a moment, I would submit to you that somebody came along, they saw the quasi-hominid prototypes here, said, okay, they're within range. We're going to do a little tinkering with the DNA to kind of shape them a little bit so that they can be more manageable and hopefully less violent or less harmful when they get to that certain magic point. They may have failed, but that was the theory in mind. So they made us in God's image. When they talk about Eve coming from the rib of man, well, duh, it sounds like bone marrow. I mean, it's kind of obvious. In fact, if you read the Bible and sort of unravel the mythos and just look at the hard facts, it looks exactly like this is what happened. I mean, it's kind of glaringly obvious. Okay, that's an argument, but that's my stance on it. Now, what I find so fascinating is if you look around the world to other cultures, like the Olmecs, the Incas, the Aztec, all those indigenous cultures in that region of Central America that we're so fascinated by that Richard C. Hogan made his conference around, or if you look at some of the Pacific Islander cultures, or if you look at some of the kind of very early cultures in Mesopotamia and so on, same exact thing, exactly the same. I mean, it's unbelievable how the same it is. You can go into Central Africa, and I think the Dogon tribe is the one that's most interesting. The Dogon tribe, of course, they talk about the same exact thing, and in fact, they're the ones that actually had a picture of a constellation, or the group of stars found the constellation Sirius, or the star Sirius and the constellations. And what they do is they mapped out, quite precisely, by the way, locations of stars that you cannot see with the naked eye. So here's a quote-unquote primitive, and I use that word very, very carefully here, primitive tribe in Central Africa who had very sophisticated understanding of stars that can't even be seen by the naked eye, and they had a very specific and very pervasive sort of spiritual mythos about the visitors from afar, they came, they sort of made who they are, they told them certain rituals. I mean, you find this everywhere you look. So it kind of suggests something might be to this. But okay, let's back away from theory. Let's go towards fact. Now, Craig Venter, who is the guy who was he directed the sort of private version of the Human Genome Project. In fact, you may recall back in the year 2000 when this was the big deal. You had Francis Collins, who was the NIH National Institute of Health version of the Human Genome Project. You had Craig Venter, who was the private version. He had a company called Celera. In fact, he made his money because he patented the algorithms used to decode the genome. That was kind of, they got his claim to fame. But, and I've talked to both these guys at length. I've talked to Craig Venter several times, actually. What I find fascinating about Craig, he's a very, very realistic guy. He's an extremely brilliant scientist, but he's also very practical. He doesn't go for myth, he goes for what he can see. And he comes up with very interesting answers to questions that probably wouldn't be asked too often. And one of the things that came up that has now a huge controversy is this thing that's called junk DNA. And junk DNA means chunks of DNA within the human genome and with other genomes as well, but humans are specifically this way. There's big chunks of real estate in there, but we cannot explain what those different sort of genomic subunits are doing. In other words, we can match sort of marker for marker everything we want to know about your physical body, different characteristics, proclivity for diseases, et cetera, because we can see the markers for them. But then there's these chunks of DNA that we can't explain. And I question that because nature is extremely efficient. If you go anywhere on the planet and try to look for life or look in places where life shouldn't exist, I'll put it that way, you find life. I mean, it's just everywhere. In fact, there's a group of researchers, there's a science called exobiology or astrobiology, where they specifically go around the planet in the most inhospitable places you can imagine. And they, you know, way down into the ground, you know, miles into the earth. They go into, you know, ice packs. They go into bubbling mud pits where it's 80 degrees Celsius and the pH of 2, places you just never expect to find life at all. But they keep finding life. And it just sprouts up almost everywhere. So it kind of suggests that nature is not very wasteful. And in every ecosystem you can think of, no matter how small or how large, you're always going to find, in every conceivable place where such is possible, you're going to find parasites or some kind of organism feeding off other organisms or some kind of synergistic relationship between species. I mean, nature crams into every nook and cranny it possibly can something that's going to be alive and breathing and sort of interacting with the other things that are alive and breathing. So if nature's that pervasive and how these resources are utilized and sort of mapped into every potential profile, why would there be these chunks of DNA that we can't explain? There's no model for this. And when I asked Craig Venter of us in person, he was at a big biotech conference here a few years ago, and I happened to spend a few minutes on him. I said, well, tell me about the junk DNA. What do you think this is? And he looked at me very carefully and said, well, we don't really know. But he was kind of saying in a way that says, look, I know that's the big question. And I know that people like you were probably thinking about it, and we can't really say, but we have our thoughts, but we're not going to, you know, say about them right now. But there's a huge debate raging behind the scenes. What is this stuff? Why is it there?
Well, it's so totally ridiculous to call it junk DNA.
Well,
they don't want to be ignorant and call it unknown DNA.
That's just a euphemism. I mean, scientists have a funny sense of humor, but the point is that it's unexplained, you know, to put that way, but that's the term for it. The point is, nature is not known for doing things without reason. Unless there was something else that came along that interfered with the natural flow of things here because there was an advantage in doing so. And two different areas pop up in my mind right away. There's a third one I'll say for later. And the most glaring one that is in my mind at this moment is that this is part of a yet-to-be-resolved genetic modification to create who we are in this current context and, more importantly, to allow us to become something we have yet to become. And then number two thought I would enter into your mind for the audience is that some people explain that there could be a message in there. Now, there could be. I honestly don't know. But I have some mathematician friends of mine who are very convinced of this. They say, well, DNA is a coding language, which it is. It's a 4-bit memory system, which it is. Could there be some kind of a message that we're supposed to be able to read or interpret when we have the tools to do so? That could be.
We have to reach a certain threshold to be able to integrate that.
Exactly right. But I think the very first one would be that's the Occam's razor approach. That the first offer, and it could be both combined. I'm not saying either one's exclusive. But the idea that we have been given a sort of extra bit of modification space. I'm looking for a word for this. So that as we step into the territory of, let's just say, for instance, our ability to enhance our telepathic capacity in a way that is supposed to be part of a larger design strategy, maybe there's some pieces of DNA that are in there that correlate to that function. They're not active as much as they could be yet, but they're there. That's one way of looking at it.
So will we have a parallel, like, with the Terminator, when the machines become self-aware,
well,
when we reach a certain point?
It's funny you should bring that up, because, I mean, I just saw the most recent Terminator. It was okay.
How was
it? It's a little bit silly, but if you like that kind of stuff, it can be fun.
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's great just to kind of zone out and watch the machines bending around. But the point is this, that in one particular potential future history, could the intersection of cybernetics and machine and living systems become so tightly coupled that they become indistinguishable and, in fact, become the new sort of master race, whatever you want to call it? Yes, that's quite possible. A lot of us talk about this, as a matter of fact. There's something called the Singularity Institute, which I've been a member of myself, and in fact, I've been to recent events.
What is that called?
Singularity Institute.
Okay.
There's something called the Singularity, which is another 3-hour talk, so forgive
me. Right, I know. But we're going to have you back.
Okay, well, this is good. but the point is that the Singularity talks about this whole idea of where all of a sudden everything gets to a vertical line, where we have complexity going up instantly, you have time shrinking down, and everything's interconnected, and we're sort of pushed to this next level of development or whatever it's going to be. So there's a kind of a scientific plot for this, and that's called the Singularity. But within the Singularity sort of rubric of folks, there is one subset, and that's kind of where I come in, that suggests that we are, in fact, heading towards this kind of co-evolutionary symbiosis between things that are human and non-human as our complexity becomes ever more difficult to manage. And as we have to resign ourselves to intelligences other than our own to manage our affairs, this becomes an acceptable norm and, in fact, becomes an irreversible norm. That's where we're going. So in the context of that, could that extend to the idea that we begin to go to implants and modifications to our body and perhaps our mind to have higher capacity for learning, for surviving, for living under more difficult conditions? And before you laugh, actually, DARPA is already doing this. There is a military intervention.
Before I laugh, DARPA, I'm sure, was doing this 30 years ago.
They certainly are, but now they have much better tools.
Mm.
And so is there going to be the super soldier of tomorrow? Probably yes. Is there going to be a much more tight correlation between empathic interaction and machines? That's already being done today, as we speak this minute. There are technologies, which I can tell you about if you wish, but the whole idea that you can think and the machine in question will respond, absolutely. This is a rote thing. You can buy it as a package. So now the thing to do is to get it to a more refined level. And there really is a specific interest in the militarization of telepathic interaction. I'm not kidding at all. In fact, Nick Vegas.
Oh, no. Nick Vegas did a show about that, and I have, I had an announcement from one of the academies about a whole publication, Opportunities for Science for Future Army Applications.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, I was listening I've actually met Nick several times. He's a very, very smart fellow, very nice guy. And in fact, I'm going to be at this thing called ConspiracyCon this weekend, and he was at last year's version, so there we are. Anyway, the whole point is that I was listening very carefully to his discussion on Coast to Coast because he cited most of the technologies I was already aware of. There was a couple he didn't mention, which I was interested about, but all that stuff he talked about is true. This is all completely rote and already done stuff, so we're sort of already there. And the question would be, to what extent is this going to filter into daily life? Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a company called NeuroSky. They're actually right here in the South Bay. By the way, I should maybe ask you or your audience, you ever hear of a film called Firefox?
Firefox, yes.
This was a film that had Clint Eastwood, and the basic premise of the film was he snuck into the former Soviet Union to steal their latest high-tech jet, except that when he stole the jet, he had to think the commands in Russian to fly the thing around. Now, what's interesting is that stuff really exists. Now, I can tell you about what we did here in this country back at Wright-Patterson. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, we also were doing something kind of like this. And in fact, the reason we were doing this is because it was reasoned, and correctly so, that the performance of the aircraft was exceeding the performance of the pilot. In other words, when you're pulling these really high G maneuvers, your responses drop down in time. So instead of having to look at something on a screen and punch a button or whatever, you can just think the command and you could buy yourself an extra half a G or more of stress. However, that's actually being superseded because the next series of jets or things that are flying around won't have pilots at all. So this may all become a moot point. But in the interim, the ability to take your thoughts and translate them directly into commands that could then control an external machine. This has been done for years. So one of the Russian groups that actually had been working at the time, doing the very thing that the Firefox move is about, came to the United States. They patented their particular version of this. At the Next Fest conference here in San Francisco about 4 years ago, they gave a demonstration. And you may recall, I'm not sure if you or Richard were there, but there was a booth set up, and they had high school kids. And they'd put on these headbands, and they would think about pushing a ball, a pong game sort of thing, back and forth. And, of course, whoever could think stronger would push the ball, and they would win. But this was 4 years ago. And, in fact, at this coming Computer Game Developers Conference, the next one that comes around, you're going to see several vendors now who are going to have computer games, literally, that you can buy for, a Wii box or something, that will have this neural interface. So that's how roaches have become. So we're very, very close now to seeing commercial, buy a box and plug it in kind of approach to your thoughts become something connected to an outside world. This is the front edge, the very beginning edge of a world that says we're going to be ever more connected to a life that has, has so many layers of complexity that we're going to have some kind of assistance, some kind of way of allowing ourselves to be helped or to have a kind of a virtual presence within this virtual realm that represents our physical presence in this world, and the two become ever more tightly coupled. So that's the beginning of a world where we begin to take it as the norm, not the exception, but the norm, that we're no longer confined to us, that it's no longer just our physical body and our brains and here and a skull, but in fact we connect to a much larger domain. That also, I think, was part of the message that we were told about in those ancient times. We were being told that these events would happen.
It sounds like that's a great selling point for people being chipped.
Well, I'm not really in favor of myself, but,
Right, if everybody else wants to do it, it's fine. Don't make me.
Well, that's a huge talk about that. I can certainly go into that.
Gosh, yeah, so many exciting things. We don't need the chipping to network our minds. We just have to cross that threshold where we all will be able to do that.
I'll give you a little insight. This is kind of funny. I was giving a talk at something called the World Internet Center. They closed down now, but they were right across the street from Stanford, and they would have these forums every so often. So I came in to give a talk, actually a keynote, of this thing called the Ubiquitous Computing Forum, which is about this exact topic. Everywhere you go, the machine follows you around and sort of knows you're part of this larger system. Okay, fine. So I was talking about neural implants and this exact idea. This is about 4 or maybe 5 years ago now. And a long-time friend of mine named Tim Hurd, he's had this thing called the Nanoscience Exchange.
Our audience is going to have to wait until we come back, Charles.
Okay, thing here, there. Okay, good. All right.
And this is Dr. Robin Falca with my guest today, Charles Osman, on Rumor Mill News Radio. We're on the Micro Effect Network, and we will be right back.
Listening to The Micro Effect. The Micro Effect Broadcasting Network.
As snow falls on the majestic Rocky Mountains, it eventually melts. The water east of the Continental Divide travels downhill over 1,600 miles before reaching the Atlantic Ocean. On the western side, water travels downhill almost 1,000 miles to reach the Pacific Ocean. As you ponder this miracle, ask yourself this question.
How many people and animals has that water passed through before it reaches my area?
Berkey has revolutionized the way water is purified simply and naturally. At the heart of these portable systems are the Black Berkey purification elements. So powerful, these elements extract pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, chemicals, heavy metals, and they can purify that downward flowing water. Berkey purification systems get rid of the unhealthy stuff in your water while leaving the healthy, beneficial materials that your body needs.
For more information on the powerful Berkey line of products, go to themicroeffect.com and click on Berkey water filters. That's themicroeffect.com and click on Berkey water filters. Or dial 888-803-4438.
Hi, John. Can I get a glass of water?
Hey, Peter. What's in the blue bottle?
My minerals.
Your minerals?
Well, sort of. It's called My Minerals. I just put it in my water. Food is mineral deficient now. That's why everyone's so tired and overweight.
Yeah? So what does it do?
It gives me more energy, faster hair growth, stronger nails. I didn't get that flu everyone's so worried about.
Wow, stronger nails. And where can I get it?
At Minerals.com. I ordered online. And with this little blue bottle, I haven't needed those little blue pills.
I should order it for my husband.
Yeah, just log on to AdMinerals.com. My Minerals, it's health in a bottle.
This is Dr. Robin Falca for Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network with our guest today, Charles Osman, who has demonstrated the ability to alter time.
So here's the idea. We were talking about chips and chipping and all that kind of thing, and I had mentioned something which was related to this. Oh, yes, that's right, the ubiquitous computing forum. So imagine that. This is Stanford, Cross Street from Stanford. It's like an auxiliary building. The place was packed, 150 people in there, all these folks running around, okay, fine. So I was giving a little talk, talking about this idea that at some point, neural enhancements, sensory enhancements, and other aspects that would allow the human physiology not to be limited by the things we're given at birth. And look, I'm rather severely sight impaired, as you know, you've seen before. I wear these huge glasses, and vision's always been sort of a problem. So I mean, I can see where this would be a good thing in some cases. However, as we all know, the Pandora's box can go either way. So I gave this little sort of vignette vision of this idea, and my friend Jim Hurd picks up by the audience. He actually heads up something called the Nanoscience Exchange, which is a very interesting group. They look at the sort of intersection of investment and futuristic nanotechnology ventures, and it's a very cool thing that he does. So anyway, he steps up and he goes, well, Charles, just imagine that. At some point, your thoughts will be monitored on a second-by-second basis. And therefore, if you're being employed by somebody to do work for them in some context, you'll be paid not by how many hours you sit in the office. No, you'll be paid by thought that relates to their tests. And half the people were laughing, the other half were not, because the other half already knew this was not that far off at all.
Well, then you have to figure out how to separate your brain and be able to have those measurable thoughts focused on your job.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, here we go. Something called defensive telepathy. So might as well go all the way. If we're going to go this far out of the box, might as well just blow the box up completely. Because I believe very strongly there will come a point in time where there will be like a military version of telepathy where it won't be just the ability to kind of see or sense something from beyond the visual range, but you will actually be able to affect some kind of change. And so at that point, there will also be what I call defensive telepathy. I can see a day in the future, you know, imagine it's the year 2087 or something, and I'm a such-and-such Class 5 military empath, and I have the ability to probe people at distance and kind of get things I need them to do or find out what they're thinking about for military reasons. But, of course, the strategy would be to develop defenses for that. So there would be this whole other layer of sort of activity going on that is so far outside the range of what normal, ordinary folks can deal with today. This adds. This is like taking complexity and cubing it, or a magnitude of orders of magnitude. Because if you think things are complex now, well, that sort of becomes the norm. And so, how many people are ready for that? Well, that's a very good question. At which point, it becomes considered a norm or an acceptable potential option to surrender your cognitive processes to a kind of a artificially magnified capacity, specifically to have both offensive and defensive telepathic capacity. And even though it sounds kind of crazy, don't laugh yet, because, as I said, the tools for this are sort of within range of being seen. You know, you can sort of see a roadmap where this is going. I would further submit that one of the things Nick Baggers did say, and I agree with him 100%, he was dead on about this, people think of things like the Manchurian Candidate and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's kind of hocus-pocus. But I think a much more realistic way of looking at it is, imagine now, we rely on the spoken word, on the expressions of others as the most direct way to understand what they're hoping to tell us, even though they may be lying on the inside. So imagine now if, instead of having to deal with the spoken language and body language and so on, you had to deal with empathic interaction at a layer of complexity. Very few people are going to have the capacity for it. This is going to become a new sort of super class. One thing I would like to talk about, if I could, the idea of classism in society. People tend to measure their status in the world by the stuff they own or the things they can show off or the physical accoutrements or forget all that. That's the still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I think that the sound just adjusted because I've been getting emails from people that can't hear you. It's so important, Charles. The stuff you're saying, there's such big concepts and people need to hear it slowly so they can absorb it.
Well, actually, I didn't quite mean it that way, but here's where I was trying to go with this. At the NBIC conference, the Nano Info Biocognitive Convergence Conference that I was talking about earlier, which, by the way, are a United States government-sponsored program. This isn't like some couple of guys in the closet. This is like the creme de creme. These are the top-level, sort of Nobel laureate-level scientists in various types of fields who come together as a policy conference to determine what certain things are relevant and what's useful and what also may require some kind of regulatory or other aspects of control. I mean, that's actually what's going on. So the one I was at 3 years ago, UCLA, a woman came up who was from Berkeley, oddly enough, and she gave a very good talk. She said, look, we're approaching a realm where neurological freedom is going to be the next big thing. And then it's such a hard thing to get a hold of, and I'll see if I can play it to you and just hopefully make sense.
Here's the music. Uh-oh. When we come back, Charles will finish telling us about neurological freedom, and that's Charles Osmond, our guest today. I'm Dr. Robin Falca for Rumor Mill News Radio, and after that, there's a subject I've been waiting all this time to ask Charles about. So stay tuned.
Survival food you can actually enjoy eating? What a novel concept. With absolutely the best prices and the highest quality freeze-dried foods in the country, consider the freeze-dried guy for all of your long-term food storage needs. Freeze-dried foods were first developed for the U.S. space program, but today they are enjoyed extensively within the U.S. military to include the U.S. Navy Submarine Service, renowned for its excellent meals. Freeze-dried foods store longer, rehydrate faster, are nutritiously superior to, and taste better than any other food available for long-term storage. Freeze-dried foods typically have a storage life of decades and have been proven by government testing to store with a high degree of nutritional value for over 30 years. With freeze-dried foods from the Freeze-Dried Guy, you too can rely upon the same products that are used in emergency feeding programs for government leaders at the highest levels, as well as senior members of the U.S. military in the event of an enemy attack or a cataclysmic natural disaster. Again, the website, www.freezedryguy.com, or call toll-free at 866-404-3663.
Hi, John. Can I get a glass of water?
Hey, Peter. What's in the blue bottle?
My minerals.
Your minerals?
Well, sort of. It's called My Minerals. I just put it in my water. Food is mineral deficient now. That's why everyone's so tired and overweight.
Yeah? So what does it do?
It gives me more energy. Faster hair growth, stronger nails. I didn't get that flu everyone's so worried about.
Wow, stronger nails. And where can I get it?
AdMinerals.com. I ordered online. And with this little blue bottle, I haven't needed those little blue pills.
I should order it for my husband.
Yeah, just log on to AdMinerals.com. My Minerals. It's health in a bottle.
At Eldorado Discount Gold, they specialize in finding the right gold products for the right people.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold has been in the business for over 20 years with a seasoned combined experience of 60 years in the metal trading industry.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold specializes in gold coins, numismatics, semi-numismatics, and also bullion. Be sure to mention that you heard this ad on the Micro Effect Broadcasting Network and get free shipping. Gold has always held its value through the centuries. Gold never lies. All forms of payment are held for 10 days to protect the customer from identity theft and fraud. Bank wires excluded. They'll protect you. You protect your family with Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Contact Eric by email at eric@eldoradogold.net or go to the website www.eldoradogold.net or call them 623-643-8785. That's 623-643-8785 and ask for Eric.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Remember, gold never lies.
Are you beginning to question everything you know? Do you suspect a hidden hand in world events? Then there's an event for you. Hi, this is George Norrie, and let me tell you about an annual conference that not only exposes that hidden hand, but provides answers. ConspiracyCon returns to the Bay Area for another eye-opening ninth year. Go behind the curtain and learn the hidden truths about the economy, mind control, the Mars cover-up, electronic harassment, and so much more. See and hear Native American activist Russell Means, former FBI member Ted Gunderson, Webster Tarpley, Alfred Weber, Dave Von Kleist, Stan Monteith, Anthony Hilder, Roger Tolsis, and more. Plus join me, George Dory, and other great special guests to meet in person. Conspiracy Con 9 at the Santa Clara Marriott, June 6th and 7th. For tickets, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844, or visit conspiracycon.com. Where other conferences end, Conspiracy Con begins.
Hello, this is Dr. Robin Falca, back with you for Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network. My guest today is Charles Osman, and as I said before, he's demonstrated his manipulation of time. It has flown. Boy.
Well, we must be having a good time because it always goes by faster when you're having fun.
Oh, so, gosh. I want to get every single thing that you're saying, and I know our audience does, so please just slow down a drop.
I will definitely slow down. I've been accused of this before. So
thank
let me go
you.
Back to neurological freedom, if I may.
Yes.
The idea was, and this was, again, 4 years ago at UCLA, at the third annual NBIC, or Nano Info Biocognitive Convergence Conference, which is actually sponsored by a group of different government agencies, and headed by Mihail Rocha, who also directs the Nano National Technology Initiative. So this is a very serious group. It's not a kind of a pedestrian conference. It's like the high end of the high end of policymakers meet science. So it's kind of relevant to get this particular vignette. So here we were at this conference, and this lady stands up, and she's actually an attorney that represents interesting kinds of laws to do with personal freedom, that kind of thing. And her whole bent was trying to figure out what would be the legal parameters, or what would be the kind of legal precedent perhaps to be settled in court someday, where the definition of personal freedom or personal information security or integrity becomes a yet-to-be-defined area. Let me explain if I may. Today, people tend to think in terms of written documents, things that they may say on the telephone, email they traffic they have back and forth, maybe their content they have on their computer desk or things of that nature as being the boundary, excuse me, of personal freedom. In other words, if I have proprietary information or things that are my personal property in that context, that's where the law says you need some kind of definition to get access to that. What happens to your thoughts? And what happens now if your thoughts are being involuntarily monitored, either directly or just by some kind of statistical variance, as it were? In other words, a couple of examples. I was telling you in the last segment, or perhaps 2 segments ago, the whole idea of defensive telepathy, and
mm-hmm.
also the much broader arena, which is where we are now in looking at the quantum entanglement signatures correlated with mass consciousness events. And let me go with this a step further. I was actually trying to get a patent myself. In fact, I was trying to develop a system that could measure this sort of in a certain kind of way, because I thought this could be a very interesting tool for driving this kind of proactive sort of future history manipulation of a kind of a scientific endeavor. I actually wrote the plan and had some flow charts and everything put together. But the point was, the first person that approached me was a venture capitalist, and he actually represented, or he wanted to represent, AOL Time Warner at the time. His point was, he said, look, if you can put together a package that will statistically measure the quantum entanglement signature of a mass audience that they're being exposed to, let's say, an advertising campaign, or perhaps a political contest where people are voting one way or the other. In other words, if you could correlate this sort of statistical bulge in quantum entanglement versus some kind of a media flow, that, you know, you could name the price, it would be priceless. And I said, no, I will not do that. I do not want to do that. That's completely where I do not want to go. And I was polite that firm said, no, I'm not going to go there. I am sure others are going there now. I'm positive. Okay, number two, we take it a step further. As I was telling you a bit earlier about my friend Jim Hearn, when I was at the Ubiquitous Computing Forum, and I gave my talk, and then he stands up and says, well, what happens if somebody's measuring your thoughts on a moment-to-moment basis as a way to create micropayments for your thoughts related to the kind of work you're being paid for? And as I said, half the people in the audience laughed, and half of them didn't. Now we're going to take it a step further. When I was at the NIBID conference at UCLA, a woman comes in who is a well-practiced attorney specializing in sort of liberty, things to do with your personal liberty and information, her whole thing was, how do we define a legal parameter for determining what thoughts are really going to be your own versus what thoughts might be available to some kind of a system that would be looking for things like terrorism or evil thoughts because you want to cause harm, that kind of thing. As you may recall, that, I think it was called Minority Report, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Where they were doing a sort of like precognitive analysis of crimes yet to be committed, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a joke. That sounds like a crazy novel, but it's not. I mean, 4 years ago, people were beginning to figure out what would be the legal parameters. What kind of court case would determine if and when and what conditions that might become a publicly discussed policy initiative? That was 4 years ago. So I'm just trying to give the audience a sort of a snapshot of just how far this has really gone. As people have said, as Richard Hoffman has said when he was at his geography event, we tend to think of science fiction and science fantasy being these separate worlds. No, they're separated by time, but believe me, they're very tightly coupled. And usually when people write about these ideas, they often will consult scientists in the field. I've been consulting myself when novels are being written. And they have a pretty good sense of, given certain trends and certain sort of social phenomena, what kind of scientific things would be the most likely to affect societies of the future. I think this is exactly what happened. And so therefore I'm going to go back once again to that first segment that we had, you know, an hour and a half ago when I was trying to explain, perhaps a bit garbled, but I was hoping to get across the idea that we were being told at a certain point in time that these things would become occurring. They would become part of our life. We would have to adapt to, and in very rapid succession, a series of events where we'd be pushed way beyond the world that we could see or touch or feel into a world that goes into this other sort of trans-dimensional, maybe to use Richard's term, hyper-dimensional world, where it's the things that you can't see or touch that have the higher value than the things, the physical things around us. We're being prepared. We're being, in a sense, sort of spiritually educated. I'm using a kind of a flimsy set of words. Suggest that if we do not have the spiritual maturity to comprehend what these things really are and use them wisely, they will be our undoing. That's what I think we're being warned about. That's the Armageddon that's coming around the corner. That's what I was hoping to articulate in the previous segment.
Yeah, that's a message that's come through loud and clear from so many cultures over time.
Correct. And what I find kind of interesting is that if you travel around the world, like I was saying about 3 segments ago, something like 60 different cultures in 5 continents that I've certainly read about, have all had roughly the same parameters in their cultural mythos. They all talk about some giant event happening roughly about now, whether it be this traumatic sort of transmutation or sort of reconfiguring of the world's population, and there would be some huge thing that we'd all either evolve through or perish. And I kept thinking, why would that be so consistent? And again, I was trying to compare that to this fanatical effort in all these different cultures who went to unbelievable extremes to build these huge, gigantic, very complex stone monuments and gigantic drawings in the sand and all these different things, many of which were pointing towards some kind of a calendar or some kind of chronological measuring device to say, this is the point in time you're supposed to be paying attention. In other words, why would that be so consistent? And the only thing that makes any sense at all would be that, like I said earlier, we were genetically modified in advance so that there could be a predictable timeline. See where I'm going with this? And then at that certain timeline, when we had these tools suddenly at our disposal, we would either know what to do with them wisely, or it'd be our undoing. And the reason that would be done was so that you could, in a sense, control your neighborhood. It's kind of like, I'll use a very, very bad analogy, it's kind of like when you're moving into a new neighborhood and you judge the quality of the houses and you sort of get a gander on who's there, quality of the schools and what's the crime rate, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, in a very simplistic way, imagine doing that on a cosmological scale. It would seem completely reasonable that if you had a race of beings or a collection of race of beings that's in some kind of way agreed to or in some way collaboratively determined to keep probing around for worlds that had proto-life forms that were within range of becoming local intelligent, it would be to their own advantage, not to some great sort of fuzzy, warm, utopian vision, but just as a very practical sort of mundane engineering perspective, it would make sense that you'd want to go there and sort of preemptively adapt or modify the otherwise perhaps more random evolutionary events came those worlds would eventually become because you want to have some control over who's going to be in your neighborhood and in what context.
Definitely.
So, I just, one more just thought to throw in there, and I'd love to have you ask questions if you wish, but this idea that we will have to be a bit more careful about our thoughts or about what we do. I was telling you earlier about this idea of the mentoring candidate, and this is something Nick Baggish was sort of getting towards. At this very moment in time, as a legally binding definition, what we say and what we sort of utter as our sort of written and spoken expression, that's the stuff that legally defines our intent. Whether you're the ruler of a country or the CEO of a company or a police officer or anybody else on this planet, what you speak and what you project is the thing that's legally binding to your participation in surrounding society, not what you think. What you think is still hidden inside your head. However, when that becomes a little fuzzier, forget about people reading your email. In other words, this becomes a very, very strange area of law. And at the same time, when Obama just came back from the Middle East and he was in Cairo, Egypt, and explained to the audience at the university that we need to have a two-state solution for Palestine, Israel, all kinds of stuff. Okay, here's the most powerful man on the planet talking to one of the most precarious situations in the world, and his words were expressing what he was hoping to convey to this sort of world-changing event. Well, that stuff may become ever less relevant, because what if the words that are coming out of the person's mouth in question are no longer his? Mm. What if the entity that you're observing or relating to as the thing that's delivering policy or law or some authority, as it were, no longer representing what that individual really means or is trying to express it, that is some kind of collaboration between other entities that are channeling through him or some kind of a larger empathic web to control or modify circumstances. This, you can see where it gets kind of messy.
Okay.
And yet, as I said, all these things are well within range. Maybe not today at this moment, but I can certainly outline a timeline and a series of events that would lead up to them. It's well within range.
Yes, where are the boundaries? That becomes so significant. And what I've been waiting for the whole show to get into, Charles, is Nightingale. You
blew
me away. You told me when we were talking that you worked on that, and that is something that impressed me so much.
Well, it's another one of those strange synergy nodes of the universe. What can I say? Back in the early 1970s, I was at Dealey for about 10 years. Part of that time was at Lawrence Berkeley. Part of that time was at Los Alamos. And at Los Alamos, I was doing Star Wars, and I probably won't talk about that too much, but I'll certainly talk about the stuff at Berkeley. So around 74, 75, some folks came in, and they brought us a box full of these. I worked with a group called Special Projects. So I'm not kidding, the name of the group.
I'm sorry, what was that, Special what?
Special Projects.
Okay.
It was kind of a catch-all for these that didn't really fall into other departments. But remember now, this is a energy lab, so most of our work had to do with energy, conversion, storage, new kinds of, we did a lot of high voltage work, did a lot of work with, all kinds of like supercapacitors and giant accelerators, all kinds of things. But we did a lot of work in specialized materials that would relate to the energy world. So we were constantly being brought all kinds of boxes and jars and canisters full of weird things, and our job was to figure it out or make it interesting, whatever it was. So one day, this stuff shows up. It's a sort of gray looking metal, has some foil and some wires. And I said, well, this has sort of unusual properties. What do you think? Can you tell us more about this, how it works, and could you do something useful with it? And I said, well, sure, here we are. So we started working with this material. Well, it turns out that material was Nightingale. Now, the story as it was told to us, and I'm just going to say what I know about it, and we'll go with that. Supposedly it came from the Naval Ordnance Laboratory at Tunnel Lake. And the Naval Ordnance Laboratory at the time was very much involved with all kinds of things to do with ships, submarines, anything that goes in the water, the underwater missiles, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So there was a lot of specialized materials that were coming from that region. That made sense. Okay, fine. Well, now, I don't know if this is true or not, but I was just recently having a conversation with some folks who were looking into this kind of thing. They tell me, and I don't know if this is true or not, this is just up in the air, but they claim that when the Roswell crash happened, I don't know if it did or not, I make no claims there, but they claim that some metal samples were taken. And amongst the things that were taken were some foil pieces that, when you crumple them up, they sort of snap back to the original shape. Well,
Richard and I.
Well, the foil that we had did precisely that. I'm not saying it came from anything from outer space. I'm just saying here we were with the serious stuff. So back in the day, our interest was to look for a way to convert. We were looking for a thermal to kinetic converter. The basic idea was that this is a homogeneous alloy of nickel and titanium. And again, I won't get too technical, but just really briefly, there's what's called a state phase transition in all different kinds of metals. Certain metals have certain state phases, which are named certainly because of the crystallography involved. So in this case, we're looking for an austenitic to martensitic state phase change. That's the fancy word for the moment. What that means is that the crystals change shape inside the metal. And in most cases, these state phase changes are very, very subtle. You can't see them except with an electron microscope. However, in the nitinol, it was a very, very robust change. It went from a very low-order orthorhombus, like a long, stretched-out rectangle sort of thing, to a higher-order cube. In other words, it would snap into shape. And this was triggered by temperature. And what we were trying to do was figure out and magnify that thermal gradient. In other words, if you cycle the material between a bath of warm water and a bath of cold water, it could perform work. In fact, it could perform a lot of work. So we were trying to build solar engines where you'd have solar heated water on one side and you'd have a cold bath on the other side, you know, like underground or in a sealed tank. And we could run wires back and forth through these hot and cold baths and actually perform work. We had these bobbins, these asymmetrical bobbins, linked together by gears. And sure enough, once you got the engine going, we built several of these engines. I said, I have one here in my house, a small one. Mm. So our whole thing was to look for a way to create a thermal to kinetic conversion system as a solar engine type of device that could be used in outer space, or it could be used in certain applications where other configurations would not be easy to do. And in fact, we got funded by a group. In fact, McDonnell Douglas at one point built a version of this that they were going to use in some project they were doing. But the question was, where does this stuff come from? I really don't know. But at this mysterious moment in time, we were given a box of the stuff and said, figure this out.
Right. You don't know where your goodie box came from.
Well, exactly right. Now, I mean, I honestly don't know what happened to Roswell, and that's completely outside of my range of discussion. Although, I will throw in one small caveat if I can squeeze it in. In the last year or so, I personally have seen six times now, myself personally, and other witnesses of similar friends and so forth, at night, using night vision goggles. In this case, we're using the Generation 3 MilSpec, I have to remind that, MilSpec, produced by Morrow Vision, using the ITT photomultiplier system, which is the exact same technology
we've had Ed Grimsley on the show, and my first experience ever seeing anything when I looked up was with you and George Gabori and Ed Grimsley last summer.
So now six times I've seen this in both New Mexico and in California, and I've seen absolutely unmistakable. Look, I've been to Vela Air Force Base, I've been to Nellis, I've been to Travis. I know high-performance planes. I've touched them. I've seen them. I actually spent some time at Beale when the SR-71 was still flying. I've seen some other, like, Aurora space plane-type devices. So, I mean, I know that kind of stuff. This stuff was not any of the above. So, I mean, what are these things that are flying around up there? One could say it's the next generation of SDI Star Wars. It could be, quite possibly. Or one could say that we're being watched by somebody. It could be a coin flip. But I would offer this. Excuse me. That if there ever was a time when somebody would want to send in probes and have a quick look around and see what's going on, this would be that time. Because once again, it coincides exactly, and I mean crosshairs on target, to the exact moment in time that prophecy said something would happen, that all these other indigenous cultures said something would happen, and that we're crossing this threshold in this sort of domain where we have nanotech and biotech and nuclear technology and gravity manipulation and telepathic sort of science all mixed together at one time. This is exactly the moment they would want to have a look to see what's going on.
Definitely. So we're living in the time of that Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
Well, as I've often said, in fact, I've told this to many people, if I knew a giant asteroid was coming in, I wouldn't worry. I would just get up on the hill with a couple of friends who live around, get the best champagne available, and just watch it coming in. Because, I mean, if you're going to go out, you might as well go with a bang.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is interesting times exactly, but I can't think of a more sort of interesting time to be here to see something going on. It is high drama. I mean, there's a positive way to look at this, of course, obviously, but the general thought would be that we are no longer confined to the things that we can see, touch, or feel. We have to get used to the idea of being very tightly and irreversibly connected to a sort of invisible world.
Mm.
This is a world that the ancient cultures knew about, but they didn't describe scientifically. Now we're there revisiting that with a much more scientific accoutrement to go with it.
Right. Well, we've had to reach this point where we can start to let our minds accept that there are these broader concepts. People are just way too shut down.
And that's kind of where I was saying earlier, excuse me, about the sort of organized religions being so harmful, because they are the thing that has in fact prevented this from happening. If it wasn't for the sort of fanatical irreversible, rigid, inflexible way of looking at their tiny little thought of, you know, this is our culture, this is our religion, everything else is evil. If it wasn't for that, we'd probably be there now.
Mm.
So I think it's kind of ironic that if we were given this sort of thought part of the brain, as I was explaining earlier, via the sort of DNA adjustment, you know, and a template made to kind of make us more malleable in a certain kind of way, it kind of backfired. And that's where I was trying to go. A lot of people seem to think that the ET, if they're out there, are perfect, that they're super gods, that they are incapable of error. I strongly disagree with that. In fact, going back to Richard C. Hill one more time, when we were at Joshua Tree, I was kind of amazed that he pulled up the film Forbidden Planet, because Forbidden Planet was a film put together with exactly this concept in mind. You're depicted this spectacular race that had developed this beautiful piece of machinery where they could think anything they wanted to, and it would magically appear just from their thoughts. It was sort of like mixed together nanotechnology and just sort of telepathic interface as a giant system to solve all the problems of war and greed and so forth. Except they missed one kind of crucial ingredient, and that was, of course, Monsters of the Id, as people say. So the Monsters of the Id killed the Krell. Well, I think that E.T. is flawed. E.T. isn't perfect. This is what kind of gets me a little bit
annoyed. Who is able to determine what perfection is?
Thank you. My dear, you got it perfect. And so I think everybody, whether it's us humanoids here or some other creatures elsewhere, everybody's on like a sliding scale. We progress through these trials and tribulations, these sort of evolutionary test cycles, as it were. But each time we learn to get past the next challenge, we're still flawed. We still have our shortcomings, and we still have the same difficulties, just that we've learned to manage them better or to become more mature in how we sort of deal with these problems as we encounter them. But if ET comes along and decides they're going to modify us to make it a sort of more manageable life form for their own purposes, it may not be perfect. And I think we are actually suffering some of the flaws from those kind of experiments.
You just stimulated
over magnification of that God part of the brain.
Huh. You just stimulated a really interesting thought to me.
Okay.
Because if we cannot be tolerant of each other,
yes,
how could we ever interact with others?
Correct, of course. That's the whole point. That's the whole point of my last 2 hours, was that the reason this would be done is to make us more, I was going to say, less harmful neighbors, as it were. Now, I think the experiment kind of went badly. I would venture that there are probably other experiments in other worlds that may be a tad more successful. I mean, I think this is an ongoing thing. The more recent versions are probably going to come out better, but it's by no means a fixed process. This is a work in progress, as is all living things.
Well, we can only hope that the awakening will take place. We all share this planet. What happens to one of us will happen to all of us, and the sooner people get that, the better.
And what's interesting, since you put in those words, it's been said not just in Judeo-Christian lore, but actually in the Upanishads and also in the Vedic principles, in more or less, I'm just sort of substitute a few words, but I've boiled it down to its simplest possible form. One of the general ideas that was expressed was that we're all part of God, quote unquote. And if we hurt each other, we're hurting God. That was kind of one of the underlying messages that we're supposed to learn, which, of course, we didn't learn too well, but that was the intent. I think that was actually why that was being said, was that if we can't find this sort of more harmonious way to coexist, then it's like all bets are off. So, I mean, again, these messages were given to us, and they were orally passed from generation to generation and translated through many different languages, and then at some point some giant civilization would sort of glom onto one of them and sort of turn into a political system. You know, it's like a really badly mutated version of what the original experiment was. And it may well be, I offer this one to you, Robin, that we may fail. We may be the last of our kind before some horrific thing goes on. But at the very least, we will serve as a kind of a petri dish or an experiment as to what not to do for others that are going on other planets.
Definitely. Don't make the mistake they did, or you'll wind up like they did.
We're like just a numbered test tube in a large box of test tubes. But, you know, there's always a value in that.
Oh, well, yes. That's another discussion we can have. One of my favorite what-ifs when I was a kid. I'll share that with you another time. It would take too long. Boy. So the next thing where people can go and hear you give a presentation will be in San Francisco on the 21st?
Yes, thank you so much. That'd be June 21st. At the San Francisco Festival Society. If you go to sftesla.org, you'll see a little board up on that. And I do this kind of stuff pretty often, but this will be the next one where I kind of go into this exact description we were talking about for the past 2 hours.
The information is on Rumor Mill News, guys. You can read it there. Don't miss any time Charles is speaking. I mean, you want to hear every word that he has to say. And think carefully why his website is called historianofthefuture.com. There's multiple levels of meaning in that. So I thank you so much, Charles, and I look forward to getting you back on the air.
Absolutely. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you. This is Dr. Robin Falkov. Our guest today is Charles Osmond. Catch him at the San Francisco Tesla Society on June 21st. You're listening to Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network.